Welcome everyone joining us here tonight on the Kings County Radio Club's Technical Question and Answer Net. I am Roy, AC2GS, and I will be your net control operator for this informal net. I will be your host, and Gene, KY2MY, will be your co-host on this exploration into amateur radio technology. The purpose of this net is to provide a platform for discussion and to offer our answers, as well as promote a conversation among all participants of this net. The club maintains an archive of these technical nets on its web pages. Also, we offer original articles and reviews on many topics covered during these technical nets. We also publish technical puzzles for our participants to ponder and as a starting off point to discuss important technical concepts. Tonight's TechNet puzzle is posted on our club website. The link can be found on the front page of our website in orange-colored type, but if you would like a simple URL to find it, you can just type puzzle.kc2rc.com. Also, we will be offering a streaming service for those who cannot receive our repeater signal. Just point your browser to stream.kc2rc.com. This net is scheduled for the second and fourth Wednesday of each month. All of this information can also be found on our club website, www.kc2rc.com. Members, as well as non-members, are welcome to participate, although we do appreciate it when our fellow hams join our club. As always, an application is always available on our website. No question is too simple. No question is dumb. All wisdom begins with the asking of questions. If you have a question, it deserves to be answered. Our format tonight will be to ask for participants to check in only if they have questions or comments for this net. Please give us your name, your call sign, and whether you have a question or a comment. The net will then address each question in order. I will try my best to provide an answer, and Gene, KY2MY, will join in as well. If any other listener has any facts or opinions, they will be free to break out the word comment, and when recognized, offer their knowledge or experiences to us all. If anyone has any suggestions for future topics of interest, please let us know either here or use our email address, tech@kc2rc.com. And now I would like to introduce my co-host for this net tonight, Gene, KY2MY. Good evening, Gene.
Gene Roy, AC2GS. This is Gene, Q Yankee 2, Michael Yankee. Good evening, everybody. Back to you, Roy.
Very good. Okay, let us begin. If anyone would like to offer either a comment or a question or an answer to the technical net, please give us your call sign and your first name.
Golf 2 Charlie, Milan from Briarwood, Queens.
Recognized. If anyone else would like to offer a question or a comment for the technical net this fine night, please hit that push-to-talk button, give us your first name and your call sign.
Boy, Kilo 2, Japan, Victor X-ray, over.
Recognized, you're on the list. I want to put their name on the list for tonight's technical net.
Roy, I'd like to check in. I don't have any comments for the net. Just like to check in. Alpha Charlie 2, Alpha Echo. Joe in Gravesend, Brooklyn, New York.
Thank you very much, Joe. Consider yourself checked in. Anyone else want to check into the technical net tonight? Please give us your first name and your call sign.
On Kilo Charles 2, Echo Traffic, Mobile, Hempstead, New York.
Very good, John. Unfortunately, you broke up in the middle of your call sign, so if you could give it to me one more time.
Going again, Kilo Charles 2, Echo Alpha Zulu,
T2. Very good, John. Anyone else want to check into the technical net tonight? Please give us your first name and your call sign.
Jason, WF2N.
Jason, recognize. Anyone else want to check into the Kings County Radio Club technical net? Any questions or comments, please? Give us your first name and your call sign.
Delta 2, Kilo Lima, November. Brian in Belleville, New Jersey, just listening.
Good, Brian. Listen away. Anyone else want to check into the Kings County Radio Club with a question or a comment? Okay, very well. We will start at the top of the list for tonight, Milen KG2C. What is your question or comment this fine night?
Hi, everyone else on the net. This is Milen Kilo Golf 2 Charlie, and I'm going to bring back one of the popular topics of grounding and bonding. When I was traveling in Bulgaria, I noticed something odd when I first arrived in the country after not being there for a while. All of the buildings had 2-meter repeater antennas installed on them. At least that's was my first thought, but as I went around the city, I realized really all of the buildings had these rods, and I realized these are not 2-meter antennas, these are lightning rods. And they're on every single building there. I literally couldn't see a building, like even a house or a big building or anything without them. Whereas here in New York City, I don't really see them very much. And I was wondering, when I put up an antenna there, should I be connecting that antenna to the flashing material that connects to those lightning rods? And, how can I make best usage of those rods? Especially since my antenna will probably be as high as those rods. I want to make sure that any lightnings go towards the grounding system, obviously, and not towards my station. Do you have any advice on grounding, specifically when such rods and flashing is installed on the rooftop and how to make use of it? Back to net control from Kilo Golf to Charlie.
Okay, Milen, that's a curious one because I was not familiar that Bulgaria had a particularly bad problem with lightning. Lightning is kind of a localized problem in different places. Long Island has it a lot more than New York City, per se. I think the lightning capital on the East Coast is down in Florida, where they have to be particularly careful and cautious. That's a sort of an interesting question. If you have a lightning rod that's already mounted, assuming that it's well mounted and well grounded, is it beneficial to tap into the ground potential of a lightning rod, or are you sort of asking for trouble if it's the highest conductor in the area and the most likely to get struck in the first place? My guess would be that it wouldn't really be higher than most amateur radio operators' antennas on the buildings. So probably, as long as it's correctly grounded, it would probably be a reasonable way of saving yourself a little trouble of grounding things and lightning protection and static electricity protection, and that you don't have to go to your own the trouble of pounding a 8-foot long copper plated rod into the ground and connecting your ground potential to that. So I would assume that all things being equal and it being properly grounded, it would probably save you some work.
Roy, that's what I thought as well. And actually, these rods, I think they come standard at 4 meters. I mean, the lightning rods on the rooftop. So they're not that tall, actually. And even if I put something like a fan dipole, or that would be a similar height, and a vertical antenna would actually be even higher than those rods. I mean, the tip of it. So I thought, well, these things are going on the rooftop. They're going to be as tall as these rods, or maybe even taller. It makes sense to bond them to the flashing that runs between those rods and that goes to the building's ground, and then run the coax to the shack. That seemed like the sensible way for me to go. I don't know if the same works for active systems. I think if I see that it's an active system on the rooftop, I'll actually hire a professional to do the grounding, but I figured for the old-fashioned lightning rods, I could probably do it myself. All right, Roy, I don't have any other questions. Just wanted to hear an opinion on that one. So back to you. We'll go to Charlie.
Okay, very good, Milen. I'm really curious about the Bulgaria's plight with lightning. I'm going to have to go and Google the incidence of lightning strikes in Bulgaria.
So far, I've looked at some maps, not at lists with data, and what I see on the maps, it doesn't look particularly bad, actually. There, Turkey's bad, Greece is bad, Italy's bad, some parts of Western Europe are bad. Not Bulgaria, really, from what I can tell on the maps. So I'll need to get more detailed localized data to see why it's like that. But I'm guessing it's just some European code for that stuff that applies to all of Europe. But surprisingly, everyone seems to follow it in Bulgaria. I don't know. Maybe there's a reason for it. Maybe there isn't. I'm also curious to research it. But as far as practical considerations, well, it's nice that they provided a convenient place to ground my antennas on the rooftop without me having to do it. Back to Ned from Kilo Golf to Charlie.
I agree, Milan. It is a much better option than the occasional time that people decide to use their electrical ground in their outlets, which is problematic at best and dangerous at worst. So good luck with that. And again, I'm going to kind of look it up anyway because, I don't know, it could be European standard, or it could be that the head of the safety commission was... had an electric shock at an early age and was traumatized, but it's a curious thing. I'll have to look into it further. Thank you very much, Bill. Anyone else with any comments or questions about this subject, about lightning rods and grounding in general?
EC2GS, K2JVX, over. Milan, I don't know how long you've been back, but welcome back. It's great to hear your voice on the air again. Lightning rods are somewhat controversial. Anecdotally, some people think, and I don't know if there's any scientific evidence, and it's difficult to prove because it's very difficult to monitor this stuff, that in an electrical storm, the lightning rod attracts a strike as opposed to some other part of the house, which I guess it's sort of intended to do. But then there's also the theory that if a house has lightning rods and a house doesn't have lightning rods, then the lightning is going to go to the house that does have the lightning rod. So what I would be concerned about if I was using it as a ground is that the amount of current and voltage, particularly the voltage that comes on light, it's like 100,000 volts or something, could just fry anything, even if you have a lightning arrestor, because now it's concentrated and it's actually coming down the rod. I would be somewhat concerned about that. That said, and it's interesting that you're mentioning this, I've read in spy books in Eastern Europe that during the Cold War, people used the leads from the lightning rod that ran along the outside of the building. They would cut it at the base where it was to go into the ground and then use that wire as an antenna. So maybe that's what you're seeing there. Anyway, those are my comments. Back to Ned.
I mean, those are all good points, Lloyd. That's why I made a point of the height. If your antenna is going to be higher than the built-in lightning arrestor, lightning rod, then the chances are much more that your antenna is going to poke at the lightning bolt more than the lightning rod might. So if the lightning rod was say 200 meters above your antenna, yeah, you're kind of tempting fate. But if your antenna is something like 5 or 6 meters above the lightning rod, then probably your antenna is going to be the thing that's going to be struck if it's one or the other. Lightning tends to want to go down to ground with the least amount of interruptions, so theoretically it travels straight down into the lowest resistance source to the ground, and so hopefully that shouldn't kind of run through your amateur radio equipment. But you could make a case for either, and I agree with you, Lloyd.
Milan, how long have you been back?
This is my second week here, and I'm leaving again on Saturday, and then I'll be back again in June. So I'm on and off here. And regarding the lightning, actually, most of the buildings in that area are the same height as this building, six stories high. With all of them have lightning rods on their rooftops. It's amazing. I don't see a single building without lightning protection of some sort, which is even more surprising it being Eastern Europe. So they seem to really care for their lightning protection. And since, yeah, my antenna is probably going to be at the same height or even higher than the lightning rods, I guess it makes sense to connect it to the flashing that connects those rods and that goes to the ground at some point, at least before, you know, the coax goes into my station. I do have lightning arresters at the coax, and I guess those will be connected near that flashing exactly, and then just run the coax to my station. And about the antenna, using that flashing, I guess, that goes to ground from the rooftop, it makes sense. I mean, it's a nice conductor for making an antenna. Back to Ned from Kilo Golf to Charlie.
Milan, every so often you'll hear about stealth antennas that some smart guy wired up the gutters on his roof as an antenna. And if you're lucky to have just the right geometry and a good general conductor, then it might work. The problem with ducts and such is if there's oxidation between portions and the conductivity is kind of iffy at points, rusty pieces of metal joined together can act like diodes and mixers and can produce all kinds of harmonics and noise. But if the gutters are built well and they're the right dimensions, theoretically you could use a gutter as an antenna.
I think Floyd was referring not to rain gutters, but the copper strip that runs from the lightning rod to the ground rod along the building. That for tall buildings, if you just cut it at the ground rod, you just have a vertical antenna with a lightning rod on top of the building, and you can load this as your antenna.
Oh, and I realized that. I was just adding the gutter antenna to the different ways that you could fudge things that will radiate radio frequency signals.
Kilo in comment.
Way.
I actually am using my rain gutter as an antenna, but only for reception only. I'm not attempting to use it as a transmitting antenna. I've got it hooked up to my old Kenwood, what is that, the R1000? It's the receiver, which it does work pretty good. I pick up a lot of stations with that.
Very good to know. As I said before, it makes an excellent stealth antenna. Your neighbors won't be anxious. They won't complain about strange things affecting their electronics because it's invisible. So it not only, if it works, it works, but it's an excellent stealth antenna. Let's go on to the next. Lloyd, K2JVX, what's your question for tonight?
If you don't mind, I'd like to pass some traffic to Milan for a second.
Sure, Lloyd. Go ahead.
So, Milan, I don't know if you're aware of this, but in June 8th and 9th, we're having a special event at the Navy Yard, and for anyone else who's listening and is interested, we're celebrating the 75th anniversary of the commissioning of the USS Missouri, and I have the permission from the Navy Yard. I'm going to do some advanced work there. We're going to be out one of the piers, and I think that the reception might be okay. It's hard to say, but certainly our transmission will be good off the brackish East River. So you're welcome to join us, and as is anyone else, we'll be coordinating this at the Kings County Radio Club meetings on the first Wednesday of every month. People should be on a list because there is a security booth, but I don't think that they're going to require people to show up at a specific time. You just need to have your name on a list. So, more information to follow with that. My question is, I know this is a topic we've discussed frequently on this net, and I haven't been on for a while, and I apologize for that. Which is the holy grail of of a digital communicator that accounts for all the common and popular modes. And I don't know if you've discussed this recently or not, so I apologize if you have, but I'm wondering what your thoughts are on the new Zoom Spot, which apparently handles DMR, Fusion, and D-Star. Back to you.
Well, Lloyd, I appreciate the hotspots. There's the Zoom Spot, and there's a bunch of PiStar in general, and I have an open spot, too, from same people that make RF Shark. They're very nice, but they're not quite the same thing as what either Kinect Systems CS8000 was supposed to be and what DV4's DV4 Mobile was supposed to be, in that it was an RF-based, direct, no internet required, that you could just switch it on to either DMR or D-Star or Fusion. What the Zoom Spot, my understanding is, as most other hotspots, is it's a method of tapping into the internet feed of the network connections of these different types of digital modes. And unfortunately, because of the vagaries of D-Star, you're not able to kind of do everything at the same time. First, you need a radio that has the vocoder, the ambi voice and decoder in it, because the Zoom Spot, I don't think, has one. So you need one of the three manufacturers, DMR, D-Star, Fusion, and then you can only cross over from one digital radio mode to another. You could use a DMR to communicate on Fusion. You could have a Mega Fusion communicate on DMR, but you can't make a D-Star talk on either of the others two because it uses an older technology voice encoder decoder. So it's not quite what I was always looking for. I regularly go to DV4's website, even though it hasn't been updated in a year. And it continues to not be updated. It says the price for the DV Mobile, the mythological radio, will be available sometime 2018, which was not really true. And they haven't even bothered to update it. One of our fellow club members, Howard, KD2MSU, put down $35 at Gigaparts. I put down $35 with DV4, and Gigaparts already sent them email saying that although they heard that the DV4 Mobile might come out at the end of 2019, if he'd like his $35 back, he can have it. So that's the way I see the Zoom Spot. If I'm incorrect in its capabilities, feel free to correct me.
No, I'm somewhat ignorant of it. I used a hotspot for D-Star. I forgot what it's called, and it just does D-Star. Wait. And it works fine. But I'm glad I asked you what you're saying, because I was going to connect to it with my ID51, which is pure, ICOM radio, and obviously D-Star. And apparently what you're saying, I would be unsuccessful to try to cross over to Fusion, and I was thinking it would be a great, simple, cheap way to get on the Fusion net of the Kings County Radio Club. So I think I'll probably just end up buying that Yaesu, whatever it is, Model 71 or whatever. That seems to be rather inexpensive to get into Fusion. Back to you.
Unfortunately, I got a Yaesu FT2DR for that very reason, that I wanted to be able to cross, go DMR and go Yaesu Digital Fusion mode. And also I picked up a DMR radio. They're rather inexpensive. So probably the least expensive way of getting somewhere around Fusion is to get a much more inexpensive DMR radio, But then you have to find a DMR network to attach to. This repeater used to be linked to Brandmeister. I'm not sure if it has a Brandmeister connection at this point in time, and the powers that be are working towards other modalities of networking our repeater and getting into it using other modes. So, unfortunately, there isn't a lot of literature out there, surprisingly, about the limitations. It's mostly the good news, not much of the bad news, but I like them. I've played with them. I've bought one, but they're not the panacea. There is a company from Japan, AOR, that sells radios, receivers that do this. They receive all three, DMR, D-Star, and Fusion, but they don't transmit. And they're rather overpriced. I mean, for a radio receiver, they go for almost $1,000. That's a kind of a desk-based radio. They also just recently announced a small mobile handy-talkie-size radio receiver, but that also costs about $800-$900. So it's rather pricey, and you can't transmit. So maybe someday some manufacturer will come out with the universal digital radio, but until then, we're sort of stuck.
Yeah, you know, I've been looking at that radio, and I have an old ICOM IC-R20, which doesn't do any digital modes, but it starts at 500 kilohertz and goes up to, 1.3 gigahertz, and it's nice. It's good to use as a receiver, broadband, obviously. But it's ancient and it's difficult to use, and it's one of those things where you push the button three different times, it does three different things, and it's kind of annoying. So I was thinking of stepping up. So I looked at the AOR and I looked at the videos on YouTube for the AOR, and some guy did a comparative of the AOR on 40 meters listening to an amateur signal, and compared it to the ICOM IC30 on 40 meters. And I was drawn towards the AOR for the same reasons why you're mentioning it, because of the fact that it does all these multi-mode digital decoding. But the audio on it and its reception capabilities were horrible in the HF bands. And I don't know if the guy who put the video up worked for ICOM, but it was like unbelievable how terrible it was. So I kind of backburnered that, especially given the high price over.
I agree with you, Lloyd. I have seen other YouTubes. Someone who happened to live very close to the main United States distribution point for AOR had bought the radio, was just announced and released, and had to kind of drive back to them about two, three times before they got a model right. There's user interface issues, or at least there was. It's not the most flexible machine in the world. It doesn't have a good computer interface, which I think radios should really invest a lot of time in doing it these things these days. But apparently AOR is not. It's a kind of a bare bones design. So in theory, I like the idea of all the digital modes, but it's not worth it to me. Because it's so difficult to work the way I saw people trying to get it to do things on YouTube. But there are people out there who just want it, or they want a new toy. I don't know which it is, but I hope they enjoy it. But I'm going to still wait for the mythological radio that can do it all.
I concur. Thank you. I'm going to hand it up back to you, and thanks very much for your input. And again, Milan, great to hear you. I sent you an email, your Gmail address, so please try to respond. And Roy, I need to secure from the net for the rest of the evening. Over.
Very, very good. Lloyd 73, have a good night, and we'll talk to you again real soon.
73, good night.
Okay, next on our list is John, KC2EAZ. What's your question tonight, John?
Apologies, I was at the fringes of the repeater area and I was just checking in. No traffic, I probably dropped there. KC2EAZ, enjoying the net. Thank you.
Okay, didn't get that no traffic thing, but thanks for visiting, and we're here every second and fourth Wednesday of the month, so feel free to drop by again. This is Jason, WF2N. What's your question or comment tonight, Jason?
Hey, Roy. Good evening, and good evening to everyone on the net. This is WF2N. Question is revolving around RFI. So, what are some good tips on identifying some sources of noise or RFI around your shack? You know, what sort of tools could one use to identify these things, if any? You know, could I just start unplugging things, or would something else do? And my next question is, when creating a common mode choke, are there any principles that we should know about in selecting a specific type of mix of ferrite? And how many turns should we use? Does it matter for a specific frequency that we're trying to null out, or is it pretty much like a, you know, just measure and test and repeat as needed? Back to you, Roy.
Okay, Jason. Let's take question two first, because hopefully question two will be much faster and easier to discuss, and then we'll go backwards into RFI. Common mode chokes ultimately are rather simple in concept. What you're doing is providing some degree of additional impedance in the common mode to limit the current in the common mode. There's two modes going on in your transmission line. There's differential mode, which is what you wanted to set up, which is feeding your antenna, which is radiating and giving you the transmissions that you want. If and when your signal gets reflected back down your transmission line, it usually is reflected in common mode. And common mode can be lessened a great deal, attenuated, by increasing the impedance. Now, you increase the impedance sort of the same way that you increase impedance any other place. You can take three approaches. One, which we won't go into too much, is balance. One-to-one balance will using toroids as transformers and such, will act as an RF choke as well. But for the sake of this discussion, you can either place ferrites across the coaxial cable outside, outer shield of the coaxial cable. You put five or six or seven or eight rows, one after the other, and you have a W2DU poor man's balance, or poor man's RF choke. Another poor man's RF choke is increasing the impedance by increasing the inductance of the coaxial cable by twisting it in coils. Depending upon the outer diameter of the coil and the number of turns, the impedance will go up. Depends on what frequencies also you're working on. If you're working on high frequencies, you don't need as many turns because inductive impedance goes up as frequency goes up. If you're operating at, say, 160 meters, that's rather low. So all these things to increase the impedance will have less of an effect. And so if you were operating a lot at 160, I advise you to slap on a few more ferrites on your W2DU type of balance, more coils on your on your poor man's just open coiled coaxial cable. That's the gist of it. Anything problematic with what I said, Jason?
That was very straightforward. Thank you.
Anyone with any comments about the common mode chokes at this time? Okay, I will take that as unanimous approval. RFI, again, there are books written about it. There should be, because it's a pain in the backside. Personally, if you can figure it out by unplugging the source of it or turning off the source of it, that's probably the easiest way of doing it. There are RFI in your house, there's RFI across the street, and there's RFI someplace out there somewhere. And the stuff inside the house, you can sort of play detective. You pull out the power warts, you turn off routers and wireless accesses, and you keep unplugging things and see if it gets quieter and quieter. And you turn off LED or fluorescent bulb ballast. And by that type of a method, it's probably the best way of finding out what's locally producing the noise. Let me drop for a sec. The problem is, what happens if it's going on in your neighbor's house? Your neighbor, most likely, is not going to let you unplug their stuff. That's where you get into problems. And it's a little bit more problematic. There are different ways that you can go sniffing for RFI. You can take a radio that happens to be tuned to the frequency where you're picking the RFI and rig up some kind of nice directional loop or something, and go looking around for it that way. Even if you find out what it is and it's your neighbor's, chances are there's not a great deal of things that you're going to be able to do anything about. Third, there's commercial, local type of manifestations. I live very close to the subway's station, the big area where they fix things and weld things and do all kinds of stuff, and I've been perpetually surprised that I don't get a lot of noise from them, and I don't think they would quiet down if I asked them pretty please. So the stuff in your house, you can do a lot about. The stuff in your neighbors, I guess it depends upon your relationship with your neighbors, and the stuff in commercial type of things, you're stuck. So that's it in a short gist. Any further questions or comments about what I said, Jason?
Thanks for answering the question. Nothing further from me. Thanks, WF2N.
Very good, Jason. If anyone else has any either questions or comments about RFI, we've all had to deal with it. I've even tried switching over to battery power and shutting down my power mains to see if it was local, which it wasn't, and that's probably the litmus test to see if you're causing it, is to shut off the power. But there's other ways as well. Anyway, if anyone has any further comments or questions or what have you about RFI and such, please feel free to mention them now.
AC2AE.
Comment.
Joe will be first, and Malen will be second. What would you like to say, Joe?
I've noticed over the years some of the problems down on the lower bands, 80, 40 meters for me, were wall warts, just common household wall warts that would basically power your answering machines. Not so much your telephones, but I know in particular the one that I had for my answering machine was very, very noisy. As soon as I would plug it in, my noise level would rise. I'd unplug it, and it would drop right back down again. I tried to put one of those filters on it that you plug into the wall. Didn't even help it at all. It was just a noisy, noisy unit. Another unit that I didn't even realize, and I had it plugged in for years, was a 12-volt wall wart that I actually had hooked up to a little 12-volt fan that I would just use to, cool things off if I was soldering, to blow the wind in a different direction. And I actually didn't notice it until Mitch and I were at the repeater site, and we had it plugged in up over there to cool us off during a summer day. And every time we would unplug it, the noise level on the repeater would drop, and for about maybe 20 minutes, we just couldn't understand where it was coming from. So after that day, we pretty much got rid of that wall wart. So check your wall warts, man. They definitely... first of all, I call them little energy vampires, because you keep them in plugged in all the time, and they're constantly draining juice. So just unplug them and see if that makes a difference. Back over to net control, AC2A.
With advice, Joe, yes, the wall warts, the two major offenders that always come to mind, I think, are the wall warts and the ballasts. Early LED lights were infamous for having switching supplies that created a great deal of noise, fluorescent lights. If the ballast would go bad, sometimes the ballast started bad, that would give noise. You know, the problem with these wall warts is that they utilize a very efficient method. Up until 30, 40 years ago, power supplies were what we would now call linear power supplies. They used transformers to adjust the voltages according to the primary and secondary ratios, and then they just rectified them and smoothed out the ripple with large capacitors. But they figured out how to make inexpensively and high quality and not so high quality switching power supplies. You could do away with the transformers, and what you did was you fed the signal into an oscillator, had it go into the hundredths of kilohertz, and then you could do all kind of magical things to bring the voltages up and down and sideways, and regulate it, and it allowed for much less expensive, lighter, and more efficient switch power supplies. But the problem is, switching at those multi-kilohertz rates, if you don't do proper filtration, all those RF signals leach out, and because they're not perfectly sinusoidal, they generate harmonics all across the spectrum. And so it becomes a big problem, even if you hook some kind of a filter at the plug-in site. You have to deal with the RF coming out of the power cord to the device and just irradiating in the little box that is the wall wart itself. So, wall warts are problematic. They're not all created equal. Some of them are excellent. I still bump into guys who don't like switching power supplies for amateur radio equipment because 30, 40 years ago they hooked a bad one up to an oscilloscope and saw a lot of junk coming out. But those days are pretty much gone if you buy decent equipment. But, yeah, wall warts, something to check. Thank you very much, Joe. I believe Milan also wanted to make a comment.
Thank you very much, Roy. I wanted to make a comment regarding the methodology for checking for RFI. Of course, the tried and true way is to unplug things one by one, but these days it's much faster if you have an SDR receiver with a pan adapter, so you can look at several bands simultaneously, and especially if that receiver or radio, it can be transceiver, of course, if you can have it powered by a laptop with a battery so you don't have it hooked up to your electrical grid, or if you can have it powered by some battery so you can turn off your entire house's power and just look at the bands as the first measure, not go, device by device, but... for example, what I did was I used my laptop and the SDR Play RSP1 Alpha, which is a receiver that goes up to 2 gigahertz, I think. And I connected this to the laptop with an antenna, with my HF antenna, and just turned off all the power to the house. And I went through the bands to see how things change and turned the power back on and off and on and off. And I saw no difference, so I knew then that... there's just nothing in the house generating RF, and it takes only a couple minutes, to do a test like that. Otherwise, the old approach of unplugging device by device it's more time consuming. So if you have an SDR receiver, I recommend you try that approach. Kilo Golf 2 Charlie, back to net.
Milan, I agree with you, of course. The method I kind of suggest, generally speaking, is unless it's kind of obvious that everything was fine until you bought some new clock or light or something, if you really want to get down to it, is you shut everything down, go on battery power, see if it goes off. If it does go off, then you have to either start turning on circuit breakers and figuring out which branch is causing it, or you have the pull out, pull back in type of way of kind of figuring out which is the naughty object that's causing it all. But yeah, there's more than one road to Rome. So yes, I agree with you, Melinda. That's a good way of kind of differentiating your neighbor's problems from your own as far as RFI production. Anyone else with any comments or questions about RFI tonight? Okay, very good. Does anyone who kind of missed the initial check-in have any questions or comments for the technical net tonight? Okay, then let's go to the TechNet puzzle for tonight. If you look, once again, the webpage is always there, and you can just type puzzle.kc2rc.com, and that'll bring you to the puzzle page, hopefully. And the question for tonight is, why are the radial elements of quarter-wave ground plane antennas usually made droop? If you've ever seen, there are some that are nice and straight, but a lot of them droop downward. So your choices for this question is A, to match a 50-ohm impedance coaxial cable, B, to increase the angle of maximum radiation, C, to avoid RF flowing on the outer portion of the feeder, and D, to prevent static buildup on the vertical element. So would anyone like to play tonight?
I'll play, Roy. AC2AE. And I'll give you a solid A to match the 50-ohm coaxial cable.
See, Joe, you are absolutely positively right. There are a lot of things that impact on the nominal impedance of standard antenna design. In free space, if you were to hook up a half-wave dipole in the middle of outer space, you wouldn't have to worry about grounding it because it's a balanced antenna. But it wouldn't have a 50-ohm impedance. It would have a 73-ohm impedance. If you cut it in half and turned it into a, put radials on it and turned it basically into a quarter-wave vertical, it would only have 36 ohms of impedance. As you bring these structures closer to an earth ground, and as you change their geometries, you alter their impedances. And with vertical ground plane antennas, one of the ways to raise the impedance from its nominal 36 ohms to a 50 ohm that your transmitter is sort of designed best to operate with, it transfers power the most efficient way at 50 ohm, is to twist those little radials down. So the answer to the question, as Joe said, is to match the 50-ohm coaxial cable. That's the nature of antennas. Very curious devices. It's an art form as well as a technology. And, there are books and books and books about it. And some of the engineering books on antenna design and how they actually work will give us all headaches because I've tried to read them. And they get deep into the math. So that's it for the TechNet puzzle for tonight. Anyone with any comments about that? Okay, once again, before I roll this all down, and does anyone have any further comments, questions, answers, statements, what have you, for this this episode of the Technical Net tonight?
You will go to Charlie.
KDC-NYS,
Glenn, you wanted to say something? Also, I heard a signal that was about 70% noise, unfortunately. I couldn't quite make out the call sign.
Oh, yes, I had a comment about the previous topic of common mode chokes in RFI. One of my favorite resources for learning about this and just gaining a lot of knowledge on it is a freely available PDF that people can download off the internet, and it really has tons of information on those three topics, RFI, ferrite, and common mode chokes. You can find it on k9yc.com. That's the personal website of K9YC, obviously. And if you go there to his publications, he has a PDF called RFI, ferrite, and common mode chokes for hams. And it really goes into a lot of detail, and he keeps it regularly updated. Most recent update was January 2019, actually. And he has a bunch of other things, but this is actually not just an article, it's a whole book on the subject. And you can have it for free, and it's very well written, has a lot of information. And I learned a lot of what I know about RFI and chokes from there. So I highly recommend it. Kilo Golf 2 Charlie, back to that.
Very good. Thank you, Milan. Well, certainly the price is right, and there's such a great amount of information available for free on the internet, and you know, most of it, thankfully, is not the Flat Earth Society. So the legitimate people trying to make more and more sense out of all these technical issues, and it's sort of a great time to be a ham. You know, in the old days, you could learn things word of mouth, occasionally from a book, but nowadays Google is your friend. So thanks, Milan, and other source material. Maybe we could put that up someplace on the club's website as a resource. Any further questions, statements, comments, what have you, for the technical net tonight before we shut it down for this time? Okay. This net has been brought to you by the Kings County Radio Club. Our club is an ARRL-affiliated club based in Brooklyn, New York. We meet on the first Wednesday of each month. Our next meeting will be April 3rd. We offer a pre-meeting technical question and answer session, much like this net, from 7 p.m. to 8 p.m., as time allows. Our regular general meeting starts at 8 p.m. and continues until anywhere from about 9 p.m. to 10 p.m., depending upon the number of points that are covered. We have a weekly 2-meter club net on every Tuesday at 9 p.m. on this repeater, as well as a 10-meter net every Sunday at 11 a.m. on 28.380 megahertz upper sideband. This technical net meets on the second and fourth Wednesdays of each month at 9 p.m. We have a weekly net featuring Yaesu's Fusion Digital Technology every Thursday at 9 p.m. on our club repeater, featuring Yaesu's Fusion Digital Technology. It's every Thursday at 9 p.m. on our club website. We have a weekly swap and shop every Friday at 9 p.m. That's done on the Digital Fusion technology as well, but you can listen to the stream. We do it on the internet at stream.kc2rc.com, and you can make comments in the chat room on our website. Let's see. If you would like to contact, by the way, everything that I talk about today is on our website, www.kingscountyradioclub.com or www.kc2rc.com. Our club website services were generously donated by the local Brooklyn-based web hosting company, 3 Alien Web Hosting, who we would like to thank. As the great philosopher Jimi Hendrix once said, knowledge speaks, but wisdom listens, so try to listen a bit more and talk a bit less. It's time to roll this all up and shut it all down, but we'll be back to do it all over again March 27th, and you're all welcome to join us. I'd like to thank, as always, all the people who participated tonight, especially to my co-host, Gene, KY2MY. Without you guys, I'd just be talking to myself. So, this is Roy, AC2GS, going clear, and getting the heck out of here. Have a great week, guys. We'll talk again.
Roy, AC2GS, this is GQ Yankee 2, Michael Yankee. Good evening, everybody.
Roy, Gene, thank you very much for the net tonight. You guys do a great job every time. AC2, AE.